there never has been a salmon stream in a strip mined area that's ever been restored to its former level of productivity.
New questions about the Chewitna coal mine proposal in Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 19th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, students react to mandatory drug testing for athletes at Juneau High Schools.
Well, I think definitely like athletes should be encouraged to be drug-free, but maybe that should be more up to parents than the school.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, one out of every three girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
New reports just released indicate that Western Cook Inlet's Chewitna River drainage salmon streams will be ruined if a proposed coal mine project is approved. Delaware-based Pac Rim is moving forward on the strip mining plan pending state permit approval, but fishermen oppose the mine, saying it will harm their livelihood and the environment. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Pac Rim first started the application process 3 or 4 years ago, but so far the company has not filed a complete application to strip mine coal in the Beluga area, just across the inlet from Anchorage. Russell Kirkham, who manages the state's coal program, says Pac Rim has made significant changes in the original plan. Kirkham would not go on tape for this story, but he says Pac Rim was sent back into the field numerous times to get more surface water and hydrology data. Kirkham says Pac Rim changes in management have further delayed the process, and the state is still waiting for an application to come in. But opponents of the mine, like Lance Trasky, are concerned that permits could be approved as early as this fall, and they are closely examining Pac Rim's plan to dig through 11 miles of salmon streams.
There are several problems with that plan. First off, there is no evidence in the scientific literature that I can find who say that there never has been a salmon stream in a strip mined area that's ever been restored to its former level of productivity. In fact, it may not even be possible to do that.
Trasky is a retired Alaska Fish and Game biologist, now working as a consultant. He's authored a report critical of Pac Rim's salmon stream restoration plan. Under state law, the mine area must be reclaimed after the mine plays out. And Trasky says he's read Pac Rim's reclamation plan and hydrology reports and finds them inadequate. He says coho and Chinook salmon will be affected the most by the mining, but all salmon stocks in the area would be hurt.
They have not looked at the genetic makeup of these salmon stocks in the stream. The problem there is that over time, there's increasing amount of evidence that coho sockeye, like the other salmonids, have adapted to individual salmon streams. They have special adaptations to the conditions in that stream, the flow, the temperatures, and everything else. And if you destroy those runs that use that part of the stream or that stream, they're not likely to be really successful in recolonizing it.
Trasky says mining activity will ruin wetlands that provide nutrients critical to developing salmon.
The uninterrupted flow of shallow groundwater to these streams is critical to salmon survival during the winter, which is the most critical period. And, of course, the strip mining will completely eliminate, you know, all the structure that provides that groundwater stream. And there doesn't appear to be any real easy way to restore that, and there's no evidence that anybody ever has. They really haven't done the kind of groundwater studies necessary to do that. So that's a data gap there that they have.
Trasky's report and two others like it by experts in the field were released this week. The reports were commissioned by the Trustees for Alaska, an environmental law firm which is helping environmental groups like the Cook Inlet Keeper and the Chewitna Citizens Coalition in fighting the coal mine. Trustees for Alaska legal action stalled a plan to mine Chewitna coal 25 years ago. Pac Rim officials reached at their Anchorage offices, chose to reserve comments, saying they had not yet read the reports. Chewitna's low-sulfur coal could provide mine production of 12 million metric tons a year from the 300 million metric ton proven reserves in the area to be strip mined. The primary mining unit would cover about 5,000 acres, and mining would take place for some 25 years. State law requires any company that plans to mine coal to put up a bond covering the entire cost of reclamation should the operator fail to do so. Coal program manager Kirkham says in addition to the state permit, PacRim must comply with federal National Environmental Protection Act standards. He says the state permitting process and the environmental impact work required by NEPA can be done concurrently. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
High school athletes in Juneau will be subjected to random drug tests beginning this fall. The Juneau School Board last night voted to accept the recommendations of a community task force.
Unanimous.
The plan mandates drug testing of athletes at Juneau Douglas and Thunder Mountain High Schools. It also sets up a voluntary testing program for other students and makes it easier for school staff and coaches to have a student tested if they suspect drug use. The board created a task force in June after coaches and others said the drug problem in Juneau High Schools was becoming a crisis, particularly the use of OxyContin. Board member Destiny Sargent chaired the 12-member task force, which has been immersed in youth drug abuse issues for weeks.
Our whole goal is to identify our students earlier, get them the help that they need, and save lives.
Board members said they were swayed by public opinion and the number of stories, some gut-wrenching, from families whose children abuse drugs and are now paying the price, some in prison. Inside Juneau Douglas High School, reaction to the new drug testing program is mixed. KTOO student reporter Caitlin Gettler has the story.
Head football coach at JDHS Bill Chalmers threatened to resign last spring if a drug testing program was not implemented. He says the task force recommendations are already working even though the actual testing has not begun.
The message got through to the football team. And when I met them for the first time on July 27th this year, I said to them, there's going to be a drug testing program in our school. Whether it's voluntary or mandatory really doesn't make a whole lot of difference, because if it's voluntary, you 45 people are going to be the first 45 to sign up for it. And what I got in return was 45 heads shaking yes.
Students at both Juneau Douglas and Thunder Mountain High Schools have mixed feelings about the possibility of a drug testing program. Emily Johnson plays basketball and soccer for the Crimson Bears. She says if athletes are faced with the choice between drugs and their sport, they would probably choose their sport.
I think they'll probably find a way around it, but at the same time, it might help slow it down because people will be scared of the consequences if they get caught.
Miguel Rohrbacher was student council vice president at Thunder Mountain last year and is coming back to JDHS for his senior year. He believes drugs are a huge problem among his peers, but the school is crossing the line by requiring drug tests.
Well, I think definitely like athletes should be encouraged to be drug-free, but maybe that should be more up to parents than the school. I think the school should be allowed to take measures to prevent students from using drugs at school, but I think the school maybe is overreaching in terms of people's personal lives.
Senior Annette Hiley is a star on both the basketball and track and field teams. She believes the program won't help kids her age, but would eventually help future generations stay off drugs.
If a player gets caught now, they're probably still going to do drugs because they're just that, a lot of them are just that addicted to it. But incoming freshmen are probably not going to want to try drugs because they might get tested.
The new policy also calls for voluntary drug testing for students not involved in athletics. The general consensus among high school students seems to be that the voluntary program is unrealistic. Hiley says kids using drugs won't sign up.
It depends if parents decide to sign up their kids, because most kids aren't going to just go, hey, let's sign up for the drug testing if they're on drugs. I might sign up for it because I have nothing to hide.
In Juneau, I'm Caitlin Gettler.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage ban on glass recycling fuels an unlikely product.
It's been insane this year. It's been like over 1,000 times what we did last year. I mean, and we can't even keep up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The United States military is boosting efforts to relocate the village of Newtok. Erosion is eating away at the Bering Sea village, and local leaders have been working for years with state and federal agencies to move the community. Now, with the military on board, the work is expected to go a lot faster. KYUK's Shane Iverson visited the site and has this story.
An Alaska National Guard helicopter is leaving Bethel to transport military personnel and government officials to the new village site. The site is only accessible by helicopter or boat. Right now, it's just a military camp, but according to Alaska's Deputy Commissioner of Commerce, Mike Black, the site is further along than expected. Inside a planning tent, Black thanked the military.
The real push comes with your involvement. Otherwise, we wouldn't be anywhere close to where we are today.
Building the new village has become a training program for Army, Navy, and Marine forces. Lieutenant Colonel Bill Morgan.
It just so happens that the needs of the Newtok Planning Group and the needs of the state and the needs of the military all came together in this very specific project. And for the 5 years of the project, I think everybody's going to get something pretty significant out of it.
The project is part of the military's Innovative Readiness Program, a model that combines civilian needs with military training needs. Morgan says Innovative Readiness seeks opportunities to train in new and challenging settings, and Newtok's move fit the bill perfectly.
To do something so far away from home, if you will, up in the remote Alaskan tundra, in a difficult place to get to by boat, by air, every kind of way, this is exactly the type of challenge that offers us a training opportunity that will enhance our ability to, you know, go to war in the future, do other engineering projects in a remote location in the future, and that's why we're here.
The new site is located on a hill about 9 miles south of Newtok on the Ninglick River. Tribal Administrator Stanley Tom.
The new village site is called temporarily Mukhtarvik. Mukhtarvik, it means getting water from the spring water. That's where we get our water when we run out of water out here in Newtok.
The military, under the direction of the 4th Marine Logistics Group, has set up what they call an engineering camp. About 30 soldiers are positioned there. The foundation of the camp is DuraBase mats, big, strong plastic sheets that are literally set right on the tundra and snapped together. Dennis Swarthout is with Aleutic Contractors.
The mats provide an instant road.
In this case, it provides a steady base for tents, generators, and bathrooms. Swarthout has installed countless mats across the state, but he said the military is using him for consulting purposes.
I was going to come out initially, then I started talking to the master sergeant. He says, no, let us figure it out, because that's what we're going to have to do in the real world. And they did.
An Army landing craft is idling along the newly constructed ramp just down the shore from the camp. The 170-foot boat is responsible for bringing in supplies cached in Bethel and the coastal village of Tuksuk Bay. Chief Officer David Carpenter is the boat's skipper. He says the biggest challenge has been navigating the shallow waterways.
Well, the river's pretty tough. The mudflats are just a nightmare.
Carpenter says the cargo vessel has been stuck several times on Ninglick's expansive mudflats, but he says the grisly conditions are galvanizing his crew.
The training, I mean, you can see the difference. When they started out, I had a bunch of kids who were pretty brand new, hadn't done this stuff very much, and now they're seasoned pros.
Soon the landing craft will be taking soldiers out of camp. Year one of the project will wrap up late this week. Equipment will be stored in convex vans. Colonel Morgan says that will give them a jump next summer.
So essentially, when the next units come out next summer, it's base camp in a box, pop it out, set it up, and get going again.
The military has committed to a 5-year project. Next summer, they plan on building an evacuation and community center. Then in 2011, they plan on building the new runway and other essential roads. In Newtok, Tom says the village has been monitoring the encroaching Ninglick River. He says the military's operation is an essential part in hastening the move. South winds have battered down the encroaching shoreline, and villagers have already moved a barge landing twice this summer.
They've been moving them further inland. We keep track of them to make sure they don't fall off in the Ninglick River.
The military plans on expanding the camp to accommodate up to 200 soldiers by next year. I'm Shane Iverson.
A settlement reached yesterday has put the Kinnick Arm Bridge project back on the short-range list of the Anchorage Transportation Plan. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The preliminary hearing was scheduled for 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, but it was about 40 minutes later that Superior Court Judge Sen Tan began the proceedings. Immediately, Richard Payne, one of the attorneys representing the cities of Houston and Wasilla, said the preliminary hearing was unnecessary, at least for the present.
I think we have a settlement.
In June, the Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Solutions Policy Committee voted to move construction of the Kinnick Arm Bridge from the short list of preferred projects to a long-term status. That change meant work on the bridge would probably not start until 2018 at least. The cities of Houston and Wasilla sued over the new status. They said their communities were not notified of the possible change and did not have an opportunity to respond. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, the state agency overseeing the project, joined the lawsuit. It was directed against the Transportation Policy Committee and its members. The judge asked Payne to summarize the tentative agreement.
General terms of the settlement is no one's admitting fault, no one's admitting they were wrong, but what we're doing is they're agreeing to rescind the vote from June, so that will go away completely.
One of the attorneys for the defendants, Jeff Stark, added to the settlement summary.
The one other provision I would mention is that the policy committee will rescind. What happens next after that is up to the policy committee to decide. If they decide that they want to revisit this issue, they will give 30 days notice and opportunity to comment.
The committee membership will have changed by at least one member. Current Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan replaces Acting Mayor Matt Clayman. Sullivan backs the bridge project. Clayman opposes it. Payne says that's just one of the factors that have changed should the committee revisit delaying the project.
They have a different governor, they have a different mayor, and they have federal deadlines that they're up against. We could actually get a bridge, and I couldn't be happier. Build the bridge.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge project itself faces other challenges beyond its priority listing. The latest estimates for the project's cost are about $680 million, with funding sources yet to be found. And future federal decisions on the habitat needs of the endangered Cook Inlet beluga whale could also affect the bridge's cost. This is Len Anderson.
Fairbanks City voters will consider a sales tax this fall. If approved, the petitions would implement a 3% sales tax and change the city charter to guarantee all revenues first go toward zeroing out city property taxes. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Sales taxes have been voted down repeatedly over the past decade in Fairbanks, but proponents of the new tax say their proposal is different. Fairbanks Fair Tax Association president and former city mayor Steve Thompson says the petitions are crafted to both shift the tax burden and specifically benefit short-funded essential services and infrastructure.
Basically, it will lower the property tax for homeowners. It will raise $8 million more, which will be distributed $4 million to roads and $4 million to public safety.
Any sales tax revenue in excess of an $8 million cap would result in tax holidays or lowering of the sales tax rate. Groceries, heating fuels, and prescription drugs would be exempt from the sales tax, and a senior citizen rebate would be offered. The city's existing alcohol and bed taxes would not be subject to additional levy. Thompson says he doesn't believe city businesses will lose customers because of a sales tax.
Go to the grocery store in North Bowl and see how many people are packed in there, and they can drive to Fairbanks and not pay the 4% sales tax, and they pay it on groceries out there too, and that grocery store is busy.
Thompson says Wasilla also reports not losing business since implementing a sales tax there, but longtime Fairbanks City Councilman and downtown business owner Jerry Cleworth says the situation in Fairbanks is different.
City businesses are surrounded by borough businesses that do essentially the same thing. A classic example would be, you know, Fred Meyer's out on Airport Way. They're outside the city limits, so they can sell gasoline and commodities without the 3%, and Safeway across the street is going to have to charge it.
Cleworth says business will also be lost to the internet and Anchorage, which does not have a sales tax. He says 25% of Fairbanks area commerce is done outside city limits, and that percentage will go up if there's a city sales tax. Cleworth says one sector of the city's population will be affected more adversely if a sales tax is implemented.
The people that really get hit will be the renters and those on fixed incomes and all, because it just makes the cost of goods higher.
Cleworth advocates raising revenue needed to repair aging roads by tweaking the city tax cap to reflect the consumer price index. That would allow property taxes to rise enough to bring in the additional money needed to fix the roads. Cleworth says the city should tighten its belt on public safety and other expenditures. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
Environmentally conscious beer drinkers in Anchorage have faced a conundrum this year. The city stopped recycling glass in January, forcing tons of beer bottle waste into the regional landfill instead. In response, many consumers are paying a premium to buy their favorite beverage in a package that has long been associated with an inferior product. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Canned beer has always had a certain stigma attached to it.
For decades, bad beer... Cheap beer, I should say. No beer is bad. Cheap beer has been in a can.
John Burkett is a local beverage distributor in Anchorage and a true believer in the potential reach of good canned beer. He says they're easier than bottles to take camping, fishing, or hiking. They're much lighter to ship, so they have a smaller carbon footprint. And Burkett says the beer actually tastes better, too. Cans do a better job protecting the flavor from sunlight and oxygen, which degrades the taste over time.
The product is every bit as good in a can, possibly even better. It's just try it. And everybody that does try it is shocked and loves it.
But Burkett didn't convert too many fans until a local beer festival in January.
So at that beer festival, I had five different choices of cans, and it was amazing how many people, when they saw the can, and of course timing, we had just learned that week that recycling was going to stop. And so it was on people's minds, and just it was amazing how many people first thing was, oh, and we can recycle this.
A six pack of good canned beer sells for a dollar or two more than similar beer in bottles. But Burkett says even so, stores are selling it so fast he's having a hard time keeping them stocked. That supply issue is one Clay Brackley knows well. He's the head brewer at the Sleeping Lady Brewery at the Snow Goose Restaurant in downtown Anchorage. A few years ago, the brewery invested in a hand canning system to package their urban wilderness pale ale. Brackley says at first, sales were bleak.
And the first couple years were very depressing, very tough.
But then the summer rolled around.
It's been insane this year. It's been like over 1,000 times what we did last year. I mean, we can't even keep up. As much as we can make the cans, they sell faster than we can make them.
Brackley has had to recruit 9 volunteers to help keep up with all the extra work. Although on this day, it's just him and a summer intern working in a dimly lit room in the Snow Goose basement. Brackley fills each can from a machine that looks a bit like a gas station coffee dispenser. Then he hands it to an intern who seals on the top and then stamps 6 cans together with plastic rings. It's a labor-intensive process. Brackley imagines a day in the not-too-distant future when Sleeping Lady can upgrade to an automatic system. The Oscar Blues Brewery in Colorado has already been on that trajectory. They began a tiny canning operation back in 2002. Marty Jones is co-founder of the company. People told him it was blasphemy to put good beer in a can.
So yeah, we knew it would be an obstacle. I mean, the first stores we took our beer to, they told us, we think that's funny and we appreciate your guts, but no craft beer lover will spend, you know, craft beer prices to buy beer in a can.
Now craft breweries across the country are following Oscar Blues' lead. Big Sky Brewing in Montana and New Belgium in Colorado recently added canning lines. Jones says it's been flattering to watch the trend take off.
It's very exciting to see other breweries who we know and love and respect embrace the package that some of them once snickered at.
Jones says he does still run into diehard beer enthusiasts who say they'll never make the switch to cans, but he's always confident he can convert them. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Filipino Santa Cruzan Festival was held for the first time ever in Unalaska over the weekend. Families from around the community gathered to participate in the flower parade. KUCB's Ann Hillman was there.
Parents took last-minute photos as they tried to shuffle 35 pairs of children into line. The kids, aged 4 to 20, were dressed as princesses and queens with their escorts. Each pair stood under arches festooned with paper flowers and carried by parents and friends. They were participating in the Flower Parade, a Filipino festival that usually takes place in May. Dressed in brightly colored gowns with elaborate decorations and designs, the princesses and the others walked 2 miles through downtown Onalaska to celebrate the Catholic festival.
It was fun to just dress up and stuff like that.
What was it like to wear a gown, like such a fancy gown?
It was hard to walk on because it was long and I kept tripping over it.
Rihanna Marquez was dressed in a pale blue gown borrowed from a friend. Hers was simple compared to the magenta creations with high Spanish-style collars and bright green dresses with bunched but flowing skirts. Some of the dresses were specially made in the Philippines. Others were ordered online. Some cost almost $200. Ana Villa Alfonso explained that though the dresses at the Onalaska Festival were beautiful, it was nothing compared to the Philippines.
The tradition, the best dress that you could, is better. We try to outdo each other, see? And the more money you have to spend, the better it is. If you go in the Philippines, it is. This is really, some of it can be compared, but we have the best over there.
Her daughter, Angela, played the most important role in the festival, Rihanna Elena. Her gown was chosen from a Filipino wedding magazine. She says the parade usually takes place at dusk in the Philippines with much warmer weather.
In the Philippines, you walk through the neighborhoods, so there's more people around and the more people singing, but since it was our first time doing it here, it was good. I think it had a good turnout.
Her role was the most important because she represented Queen Helena, the mother of the first Christian Roman emperor, Constantine. Father Nelson Murilla explained that Santa Cruzan is more than a beauty pageant. It's also a religious festival.
So it's a celebration of the founding of the Holy Cross in Jerusalem, I think, and then through Queen Helena, or that is Maria Elena, and then they brought it back to Rome.
Father Murilla said that bringing the Holy Cross to Rome helped establish the city as the base for Christianity. The festival celebrates that event and also honors the Virgin Mary through offerings of flowers. As the couples walked down the streets of Onalaska, they were followed by an image of the Virgin and prayer songs playing from a car radio. In the Philippines, they would be followed by choirs, but that was harder to organize for the first festival in Onalaska. This year's Santa Cruzan was organized by the Filipino American Society as a way to show off Filipino culture to the rest of the community. It was also a fundraiser for PhilAm and for Channel 8 so that the station could provide more Filipino programming. In Onalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander and Caitlin Gettler in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Newtok, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Onalaska. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.